Hello, everyone. This is Mireille Gino, and you're listening to the New Books in African American Studies podcast. Today, we have as our guest Catherine Beicher, author of Crafting Lives, African American Artisans in New Bern, North Carolina, 1770 to 1900, published by University of North Carolina Press. Ms. Beicher, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Great. I wonder if you'd just begin by saying a few words about yourself, in particular how you came to be a historian or how you came to your current professional position, and also how you came to write Crafting Lives.
Well, naturally, it's a long story, but I've spent many years in historic preservation in North Carolina, working since 1971 until through the year 2000 at Archives and History in Raleigh, North Carolina, at the State Preservation Office. And in the process of doing National Register of Historic Places research and architectural survey work and so forth, I got very, very interested in writing about architecture and particularly researching and writing about the people who created the architecture. And years ago, some colleagues and I developed a research project that was funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities to produce the book called Architects and Builders in North Carolina, A History of the Practice of Building. And one of the things that surprised me the most was the tremendous amount of information that kept turning up about African-American artisans in the building crafts, carpenters, masons, and so forth. So long ago, in 1984, I published an article about that aspect called Black Builders in Antebellum North Carolina in the North Carolina Historical Review. And that subject continued to interest me. And so several years ago, when I had finished a couple of ongoing projects and I was looking around for a new challenge, a new opportunity, something to do, I realized that I was still interested in that subject, which is very important to me, and decided to see if I could figure out a narrower way to research that in a single community and sort of to dig a deep hole in one place, as people say, to get acquainted with a population of people long since dead, of course. And New Bern, North Carolina has a rich Black history, has a great local library, and so I proposed that idea to Kay Williams, who was head of Tryon Palace Historic Sites and Gardens at that time, at the encouragement of a mutual friend, because the Tryon Palace had recently received a grant from the Wachovia Foundation to support research and public use of Black history as part of their overall program, which they called One History, Many Stories. So I pitched the idea to Kay, and she saw the possibilities for it right away. They already have African-American History Advisory Committee working with Tryon Palace to develop their treatment of African-American history more fully. And so I worked with that committee and with the support of Tryon Palace and the Wachovia Foundation grant, conducted the research for the project. And it's just been, I found a lot more than I ever anticipated, and it's been ever so much more rewarding than I expected.
Well, you mentioned Tryon Palace, and I wonder if we might sort of get into the first chapter of the book, which sort of outlines the setting, and maybe you can tell us a bit about New Bern. There was a lot that I learned about New Bern in reading the book, including its history as the colonial capital and being the largest city in North Carolina at one time. And among the largest, most cosmopolitan cities in the South. So I wonder if you'd just tell us a bit about that and also for the listeners to tell them a bit about Tryon Palace.
Well, New Bern, it was, as you mentioned, a port and a colonial port, a colonial capital. And for a long time, from the 1760s or 70s until through the early 19th century, it was the largest town in North Carolina. That it was still small because North Carolina was largely rural and none of its towns grew very large because of the difficulties of navigation and the absence of an excellent port. But New Bern was remarkably cosmopolitan for its size. It had all the dimensions of a, quote, city. And it also had a good deal of wealth. It had trade with distant ports, England, New York, whatever. And it also had a remarkably strong black community from the very early days. There were a good many free people of color who settled in that area, particularly in the rural county, but also in the town. And there was a black majority, including mostly slaves, in New Bern from its earliest years until the mid-20th century. One of my goals was to sort of highlight the importance of North Carolina urban life. So often, as you are probably well aware, so often treatment of African-American history and urban history in the South leap over North Carolina. Mm-hmm. It's like there's nothing between Virginia and Charleston. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we Tar Heel folks, I haven't adopted Tar Heel from Kentucky originally, but we're pretty proud of our state and its history, and I kind of like the idea of saying, hey, look at New Bern. It's important, too. Mm-hmm. And the more I learned, the more I realized that New Bern was an extraordinary place, and I try to outline that in this book to show that it was not a little Charleston. It was not a little New Orleans. It was its own self, and it had its own characteristics. And as you asked about Tryon Palace, one of the things that distinguished New Bern in the colonial period was the fact that Governor Tryon, who had come to North Carolina as lieutenant governor and then became governor, decided to build what's now called Tryon Palace, the governor's residence and meeting place, which in New Bern is the most centrally located port along the North Carolina coast. And he employed an English-born architect, John Hawks, to plan the palace, which was the grandest building in North Carolina by miles. It was completed in 1770. It was a grand brick building in a Palladian classical style. And it was the single building that travelers through North Carolina would point out as being elegant and excellent. It did burn in the late 18th century, though, but its memory remained strong. In the mid-20th century, it was rebuilt from the original plans and from archaeological information in a 1950s, but still rather authentic replication of what had been there. And it's been the big tourist attraction. It now has a history museum associated with it, and the interpretation of it has, under Kay Williams's guidance and subsequently, they've tried very, very hard to expand the interpretation to what they call, as I mentioned, one history, many stories, to suggest that New Bern and Tryon Palace's history is one of a diverse population. Kay Williams, by the way, died not long ago. She died in 2012, I believe. Let me double check. And this book, my book, is dedicated to her. If it hadn't been for Kay, who saw it through, yes, she died in 2012, shortly before her birthday would have come on November 6th. But she was a great friend of this project, and if had it not been for her and her faith in the project, this book would never have happened.
Yeah, and you do have a nice dedication at the beginning of the book to her, so that's an important acknowledgement. So you mentioned with Tryon Palace, as well as there were other sort of edifices that burned in New Bern, sort of throughout the early national history. As well as throughout the colonial period, early national history, and so on. And you also mentioned, again in the first chapter, that along with that, scarcely any craft items made in New Bern survive, anything that can be identified sort of unambiguously as such as being made in New Bern. And you cite a couple of interesting reasons for that. One, the preference for imported goods and just the lack of sort of a culture of identification and intentional collection of craft objects. And so I wonder what sorts of challenges that posed in terms of researching this book, and how you got around those challenges.
Well, that's a really important point. I'm glad you brought it up. I think that I had two major surprises in this book, in researching this book. In documentary sources, and particularly through the web, I did a lot of my research on the web, as many people are doing these days, but also through other, all kinds of different documents. I found more information about African Americans, both enslaved and free, than I ever would have imagined possible. It was stunning how much information I could find, a little needle in a haystack, one at a time. But the other surprise was the disappointment. And you mentioned, I had hoped and even thought that with some digging and some connections, we might be able to attribute specific material objects, artifacts, to African-American artisans. But it turns out that of the buildings that we have documents showing that African-Americans actually built them, those, by bad chance, have disappeared, the Craven County Jail, and a few others. There are others. There are a few buildings that we're reasonably sure African-American artisans would have worked on, but we don't have the specific documentation. I had hoped that there would be pieces of furniture that, or other, perhaps a carriage, or perhaps who knows what, that family tradition or research could link to specific artisans, possibly slaveholders, possibly slaves, possibly free blacks. But in fact, it turned out that as far as anybody knows, and there's been a lot of investigation, there are no Newbern artifacts such as furniture, no Newbern artifacts at all, except for silver, that are documented to any particular maker. There is a good deal of Newbern area furniture, and we know names of Newbern area cabinet makers, furniture makers, but we don't know which ones made which things. There is a silversmith, and more than one silversmith in Newbern, whose work is known, but they were white, and to my knowledge, at least based on the research I could do, none of the silversmiths apparently owned or employed African-American silversmiths or assistants or anything like that. There was a In Charleston, there was at least one African-American silversmith whose work has been known, but not in North Carolina. So what it meant was that I could not point to the particular style or way of working based on the artifact that went with any particular African-American artisan. I wished I could have, but maybe someday some material will turn up. Maybe some objects will turn up someday, but they haven't so far.
Interesting. Yeah, as I said, I was in reading that you were, you know, able as folks reading the book are able to see, you do have a remarkable amount of documentary evidence that you use, and so I was very curious, sort of in the absence of of material remains, how you were able to do that. So that's really interesting to hear. Again, just maybe backing up a bit from that first chapter, and sort of taking the larger lens of the book and its subtitle. I wonder if you might sort of talk about the interplay with a larger sort of American artisan identity, and how that plays in more specific terms with African Americans in Newbern, because I think that that's one of the larger concerns of the book.
Absolutely, that is one of the larger concerns. And interestingly, that was something that I came to understand fairly late in the process. I started out simply by trying to learn as much as I could about as many of the black artisans in Newbern as I could, simply, you know, gathering facts, putting them in some order eventually, and drawing links between them as much as I could, and found out a tremendous amount. But it was actually when I submitted my manuscript to the University of North Carolina Press that the readers, you know, university presses always get outside experts to read the manuscripts they receive, And then they make comments on how the book might be improved. And they did. And they really pushed to say this needs to address a bigger question. You need to address a bigger question here. This is a good narrative, but it needs to touch on larger arguments. And so I looked and looked about that and thought and thought, and finally realized that there had been treatment in a wonderful book called American Artisans Crafting Social Identity, 1750 to 1850, addressed the question of what was American artisan identity in places besides just the northeastern states and cities where artisan identity studies had been the most prevalent. And one of the articles essays in that, raised the question of how could African-American artisans in the South fit into the picture of American artisan identity, because American artisan identity was grounded in a sense of independence, in a sense of reliance on trade, on relationships, and to assert a social identity. And what I realized was that although it was difficult and there were many hard questions, that actually these artisans in New Bern, they were numerous enough, and they were strong enough, and they were self-aware enough that they really did claim a place as artisans within the larger artisan identity, in which they were claiming to be. They were proud of their identity. They were proud of their artisanry, and they grounded their social identity in that trade. One of the things that I point out in the book is that it's easy to see, as in many communities, it's easy to see how white racial concepts could stifle black development of their identities as citizens and artisans. But because of New Bern, I found that, especially in certain favorable periods, we could ask, what did these artisans do when they could? Mm-hmm. And what I found was that what they said when they had a public voice, and especially what they did when they could, really did show the essential values of American artisan and citizen identity. And so in that way, I hope to open up that larger story and hope that people will look at African-American artisans in such terms in other places. It's hard to know how true the New Bern model, how well that model applies to other communities, mm-hmm. but I'm hoping maybe that will open up a little bit. Yes. One of the good examples I liked especially was, there was a carpenter named Thomas Newton who had been born in slavery and become freed, but when he bought and sought to free his wife, who was also enslaved, and he identified himself as a master of his trade, and he wrote in his petition that he had gotten the money to buy and free his wife, quote, by the fruits of his honest industry, mm-hmm. which was just exactly the same language that white artisans in the Northeast and elsewhere were using to claim their place in society and the economy.
And that's actually, the fruits of honest industry is actually the title of your second chapter. So
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. I like that phrase.
Yeah, no, it is a fantastic phrase. Well, and just that is really interesting, that, you know, this idea that the racial mores of the South make participation in this identity a sort of problematic or complex proposition for blacks in New Bern. But you mentioned that more generally, a sort of American artisan identity was based largely on independence and trade and relationships. And one of the things that I found really interesting in your book, it's sort of a recurring theme, is this idea of the sort of familiarity and mutual knowledge of the blacks and whites in New Bern that sort of come from this, you know, close proximity.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you might sort of talk about that, how in fact those relationships and trade that were characteristic of non-black artisan mm-hmm. citizen identity sort of translates in this way.
Well, one thing that I think we all have to be aware of is that so much of our recent understanding of the late 18th and early 19th century about racial relationships and proximity is really off, mm-hmm. because so much of our history has, so much of that has been seen through the lens of the post 1900 and thereafter Jim Crow segregation. I mean, certainly the South in which I grew up was a segregated, very segregated South, Lexington, Kentucky. And much of the history was the South has been written since that time. And is we just see that past world through a lens of rather strict segregation. But in fact, particularly in the late 18th century and the early 19th century, the cities were, if you walk down the street in the city, you would see black and white people everywhere and see them in many cases interacting and in many cases living side by side or at least fairly nearby, because cities at that time, small cities at least, were race mixed places in terms of race, in terms of class, and in terms of use. There would be a blacksmith shop or a business near, not far from a church from a big house or a little house. So there was interaction almost all the time. In fact, northern districts, where things were a bit more segregated sometimes, northern districts in the early 1800s in New Bern were amazed at the amount of interaction and the fact that white artisans, for example, white carpenters, let's say, would take black apprentices to train them in their trades, which was not happening in the north. In fact, in some northern towns was against the law, or at least against the custom. So it's just ever so much more interaction. Now, that's not to say that there was, quote, social equality. Mm-hmm. There certainly was not. There was a strong hierarchy of race and class, and everybody was totally aware of it. So just because you saw somebody talking to each other in the street doesn't mean that they were going to invite somebody into their house.
Right.
Except maybe to fix the roof. Mm-hmm. So there was a really strong hierarchy of race and class, but within it, there was a good deal of interaction. And in fact, I mean, for example, Donat Mumford, who was a brickmason and plasterer who became free when he was around 30, he was very well known in his trade. And at one point, he was appointed to a committee with other leading craftsmen, building craftsmen in town, who were all white, to serve on the committee to evaluate the structural integrity or strength of the tower at Christ Episcopal Church. And he also was a member of Christ Episcopal Church, which was both black and white people in the church. So in those ways, there was more understanding of individual personalities and characters than there would be later. I mean, it's, to some extent, even in the 1850s, but particularly after 1900, there was a more monolithic sense of race than there was in those days. And so in the early 1800s, for example, I think people, the white leadership had a stronger sense of the individual people in the black community. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's true in any town at any time, mm-hmm. that there are people who know each other personally, mm-hmm. and know people's reputation, and that kind of is a variation on the seemingly monolithic racial relationships, that there are personal relationships and personal knowledge that works kind of counter to that.
And along with that, and here we sort of might come to again, the second chapter entitled The Fruits of Honest Industry, that covers the period 1770 to 1830. This, again, something that you come back to a few times in the book, these part of what seems to be sort of structuring and in some ways sort of facilitating these relationships is this idea of enactments or performances of deference that are tied to color and place, and mm-hmm. you mentioned that in the second chapter, and I wonder if you might sort of talk about that specifically to in relation to the artisans who are these skilled workers and yet again sort of have very specific places in this hierarchy and how they might have walked that line.
Right. Well, we can only imagine what it would have been like psychologically for these individuals to operate successfully in that world. There's a quote in here that you've read that describes John R. Green, who was a tailor, a very successful tailor. He too was gained his freedom as a young adult, and a rough contemporary of his at one time wrote, from memory, a white man wrote that he was a tailor employing several journeymen and apprentices who turned out a good style of work. He was a bright mulatto and always dressed in the latest fashion, making his own figure an advertisement of his proficiency in the art of improving the looks of men. He was much respected for his modest, unassuming behavior, though he possessed wealth enough to put on airs. And to me, that just kind of sums up the strategies that so many people had to use. And this is not something that's disappeared in terms of having confidence in your own ability, having skills, having probably a pretty outstanding place in your own social circles, but at the same time presenting an unthreatening and, as you say, deferential manner to the white master class and the whole white population, so that they would not try to cut you down.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that must have been always. It must have been incredibly stressful, mm-hmm. as so many racial constructs are stressful on participants today. But for the people who succeeded, they somehow mastered it to some extent. You know, how much we don't have any firsthand statements about that from the people who had to accomplish these performances. These are all outside commentaries.
So I wonder if you might tell us about the sorts of items that were being manufactured by African-American artisans at this time, and as well as the system wherein their wages were being diverted to owners.
Right. Mm-hmm. In answer to the first part of your questions, African-American artisans in New Bern, at least, really did practice all the essential trades. And they made all kinds of things that people needed in a time, as you mentioned, when people, handicrafted elements locally made were very important, as well as, especially in places like New Bern, imported things. But there were black carpenters and masons who built buildings and plasterers who, guess what, plastered inside and outside. There were not silversmiths, as far as we know, and not gunsmiths, as far as we know, who were people of color. But there were dressmakers, tailoresses who made, women who made men's clothing, tailors, shoemakers, bonnet makers. Especially important were two essential trades. Blacksmiths who made horseshoes and hinges and handles and nails and barrel hoops and all kinds of things that people needed every day at their forges. And then there were also coopers, who we don't think much about today, but coopers were really, really important, and a great number of them were African Americans. And they made barrels and casks of all kinds out of wood and with iron rings around them. And they those things were absolutely essential to most of the economic engines of New Bern and much of the South, much of the country, I suppose, because New Bern, for example, was a major shipping point for naval stores, the sap-based products of the pine trees that were used for caulking ships and whatnot. And those all had to be shipped. That all had to be shipped by the bazillions in barrels that were made, at least for a long time, by local coopers. So coopers were terribly important. And then in the late 19th century, when they became barrel factories, then the coopers' business kind of dried up. And blacksmiths, too, with the invention of the automobile and mass production. So mass production would cut into these things. But in answer to the second part of your question, what was called slave hiring was really important in the antebellum period, in which an artisan or a laborer, whoever, would be owned by a certain person. And let's say James belonged to Mary Smith. And Mary Smith might have been a widow who had inherited James from her husband, let's say. And let's say James was a blacksmith. And so what Mrs. Smith might do would be to arrange with Mr. Brown that Mr. Brown would hire James, the blacksmith, for a certain amount per month, or perhaps for a whole year. It would depend. And then James would receive a little of that money that he earned, but most of it would go to his owner. And this was called slave hiring. And it many, many, many of the enslaved artisans of the day did not belong to an artisan, another artisan. They belonged to a widow or a lawyer or a planter who would then hire them out to profit from their skilled work. But in some cases, there was an operation, a system called self-hiring, which drove the authorities nuts because it allowed slaves more autonomy, but it suited both the slaveholder and the slave hirer pretty well and offered some opportunities for autonomy to the hired artisan, because what the artisan would do would be to find his own employer, make his own arrangements, and then take his pay for his work, and then give over a certain amount of it to his owner. So the owner didn't have to look after him or provide his food or housing or anything necessarily. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes people would live out too, away from their owners. So that was that much more autonomy, which the authorities were constantly passing rules against this. And because, as we can tell, when a rule gets passed a lot, it means people are doing it.
Sure.
Whatever it is. And so there was constant rules about how you would get a badge, and people weren't getting a badge, and rules and regulations about self-hiring and slave hiring, because clearly it had economic benefits, but to many people fearful of slave rebellions or slave autonomy, it presented a lack of control. There's a recently reading a biography of Denmark Vesey that is really good about in a description of how the slave hiring system operated in Charleston. And Charleston, of course, was a place where slave insurrections were not unknown. And but in any case, that book, along with my book, really explain how the slave hiring system works. Sometimes, it's only recently, I think, that most scholars have realized how important these semi-autonomous slaves were to the picture of urban life in the antebellum period, because they were not locked into the gates, behind the gates of their owner's establishment all day. They were out and about. They were doing work. They were working for other people. And in Wilmington, North Carolina, in fact, the slaves, there were not very many free people of color, but there were lots of enslaved people who worked essentially on their own. And the white artisans would complain about it because they were often underpriced, they thought. And there's one scene in which the white artisans in Wilmington, North Carolina, this didn't happen in New Bern to my knowledge, in Wilmington, tried to tear down a building that a black contractor, an enslaved contractor, was building, and then this enslaved artisan had actually employed other slaves to build the building, and there was a lot of tension over that.
That is really interesting, but for a number of reasons, because you do mention sort of mid 19th century, almost 30% of free New Bernians were black, and similar proportion of black New Bernians were free. So it's a sort of really unique setting in terms of that, but to the point that you just made about the sort of economic benefits to the enslaved artisans. In a lot of instances, they were working toward purchasing their own freedom, that of family members, toward property ownership. And I wonder if you can sort of talk a bit about those sorts of overriding goals, I guess.
Well, in the late 18th century and the early 19th century, particularly kind of in the spirit of the American Revolution and the rights of man and so forth, it was not as difficult as it would be later for an enslaved individual to gain their freedom. There were white and later on people of color who owned slaves who were willing to emancipate them if enough money was available to put up the bond that was necessary under North Carolina state law to guarantee the good behavior of the freed person. So it's expensive. Mm-hmm. It was expensive to emancipate in North Carolina. But in New Bern especially, it happened increasingly in the early years of the 19th century, of the early 1800s, in which both free and both white and subsequently free African American people would emancipate their slaves, and then those people would in turn help others to gain their freedom. And this is how most of the leading artisans in New Bern became free, and New Bern had an unusually large percentage and number of free people of color and a large number of emancipations as a result. And it was kind of a circular pattern. The more emancipations, the more free people of color, the more free people of color, the more emancipations would happen. But in around 1830, that changed. Mm-hmm. And with the sectional tensions between North and South growing worse, the South getting more fearful of abolitionism, mm-hmm. the Nat Turner Rebellion scared a lot of people, all sorts of things were going on. And so state laws were passed that made it a lot harder for anybody to become emancipated. But even so, the number of people in New Bern that were already free, had already attained some status, were already taking apprentices, were already buying slaves and owning property. They had already created a strong community. Mm-hmm. So New Bern was pretty extraordinary at that time for that.
Well, and just to that point, right? Just as you say, the ownership of slaves and an established apprenticeship system. Sort of help to protect independence or relative autonomy and stature as citizens. That's something that you say explicitly in the second chapter. And I wonder in the third chapter, you talk about sort of the changes that come in the wake of these of 1830 and sort of the tightening mm-hmm. and establishment of Negro codes and that kind of thing to sort of restrict, limit the franchise and any right. number of things. I wonder if you can speak specifically to the changes in the apprenticeship system, because that seems also to be a really critical turning point again in this, in the
right. Well, what it appears from these apprenticeship bonds, and it can only read so much into the evidence, is that, after about the late 1820s, the number of African American master artisans who were assigned apprentices by the courts dropped off considerably. Mm-hmm. And it might have been an economic problem. It may have been a racial thing. I have no idea. The other thing is that the number of as John Hope Franklin points out in The Free Negro in North Carolina, a classic work, what one of his charts shows is that although the courts continued to assign free children of color to apprenticeships, they seldom, much less often did they, after 1830, did they assign them to learn skilled trades. More and more they assigned them to as farmers, which really meant a farm laborer, or women, young girls as spinsters, which might teach them to spin, which was more just teaching them domestic skills, such as a servant might have or such as a mother might later have in a household. One of the other things that changed in a big way was that up until 1835, as you may have seen, in North Carolina, free people of color could vote mm-hmm. according to the same qualifications as whites. It was only males, and it was people that owned a certain amount of property. But in any case, in New Bern, there were such enough free people of color who qualified in terms of their property holdings that there were enough African Americans voting that it really made a difference in the elections, and the candidates for office would make appeals to them and create relationships with them and look up for their interests. So they really had some actual political agency. Mm-hmm. In 1835, possibly partly as a result of their strength in New Bern, the black free blacks were forbidden anymore from voting. The North Carolina Constitutional Convention of 1835 passed a constitutional amendment disfranchising all people of color. Of course, women of no color could vote.
Well, and that was a really interesting point in the book, right? This idea that there was before this period the right to vote throughout North Carolina, but in New Bern, it was at an exceptionally high rate for just the reasons you mentioned. Because in a lot of you suggest that in a lot of cases there might have been voter intimidation and other things preventing people from voting in other parts of North
Carolina. Well, and also I don't know that anybody's really taken a research look at black voting, free black voting across the state.
Right.
But only in a few places were there enough free blacks to vote to make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, perhaps intimidation kept some away from the polls. I don't really know that that's been looked at. If it has, I've missed it. But it would be an interesting question.
Yeah. Well,
but you know, you're going to vote. You're more likely to vote if you think it's going to make a difference.
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
If there's only three of you in town, what good is that going to do?
Right. Well, before we sort of talk about some of the implications of that sort of limited elimination of the franchise. One of the things that I thought was really interesting as well was a couple of things about the artisan population. I hope I'm not getting this wrong, but it seemed that it was a higher proportion of artisans that were runaway slaves. And I don't know if I'm getting that right, but you do talk quite a bit about the artisans who made escapes from New Bern and nearby places, and also a number of people who taught themselves to read and write as part again of bettering themselves and improving their economic and other prospects. So I wonder if you could talk about those.
I don't really have figures on, you know, the proportion of runaways that were artisans. There are some studies of colonial runaways that I read that indicated that that a higher percentage of runaways were artisans than perhaps were artisans in the total population. But I don't really know that. But certainly it was true that if you had a marketable skill, and if you had already the expertise of working in the larger world a little bit, you would probably, and some confidence in your ability to find work, you might be able to escape more readily and find a new situation in which perhaps you could remain free. Certainly there are lots of runaway notices describing artisans who were runaways. These mostly, not surprisingly, were young men between the ages of, let's say, 16 or 18 and early 30s. I did not find female artisans as runaways from New Bern, but there were some from other places. Freddie Parker, African-American scholar, has written a book called Stealing a Little Freedom that's about this question, and it's a very important source. But in any case, yes, one of the advantages you might have if you were an artisan running away, if you could read and write, you were ahead of the game, because you could perhaps forge a past that would say that you were authorized to go from New Bern to Wilmington in the service of your master, let's say, or you could write a past that stated that you were a free person, and because people were often checked for their passes to make sure they were not runaway slaves, and so if you had a forged document, or you could make one for your friends.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big advantage. It wasn't until the 1830s in North Carolina that state law forbade the teaching of reading and writing to slaves. Mm-hmm. Up till that time, it was not forbidden, although probably some masters didn't allow their slaves to do that. But there was no law against free people of color learning to read and write.
Mm-hmm.
There were no public schools for blacks, but in New Bern at least, and probably in a few other places, there was a school operated by a free person of color, John S. Stanley and his wife Fanny,
mm-hmm.
that taught free children of color, and a tremendous number of those children were the children of artisans in town. And some people came from other communities to go to school there. So it was, they didn't go through high school or anything there, but they did learn to read and write. One particularly successful African American artisan, I think, stayed in school till he was 13, and then went to work on an apprenticeship to learn his father's trade. So they could read and write, and that was a tremendous advantage in dealing with the larger world.
Interesting. Well, you just mentioned that there's no documentary evidence or not much of sort of female artisans that were runaways, and that I think points to the broader question of women, African-American women artisans were their identities as artisans were largely documented, particularly if they were married. And I wonder if you could sort of talk about that absence and presence in the
right. Well,
historical
interestingly, if you were an artisan, a female artisan, your job assignment, if you will, had gender specific characteristics that paralleled the job assignment occupational identity of white women. If you were a female laborer, you might just end up sleeping the streets or working in the fields along with males. But if you were a female artisan, you have never seen a female artisan blacksmith, for example. But there were women artisans of color in all the same trades that women artisans who were white practiced, and those were the ones you might suspect. They were primarily spinning and all kinds of sewing, particularly tailoring, dressmaking, and in some cases, I think, bonnet making. And these were considered relatively genteel occupations in some cases, and seamstresses. Seamstresses could be anybody from somebody that could simply hem up a garment to somebody that could really make a beautiful fine dress or a range of skills. And there were a tremendous number of both black and white, married and unmarried, young and old, seamstresses in New Bern, as there were in lots of places. And typically, if a woman was married, black or white, typically the census did not indicate her trade, although occasionally it did. It would say she was keeping house, let's say. But if she was single or widowed, or in rare cases divorced, if she was a single head of household in some way, or a single member of a household, such as the grown daughter living in her parents' home, then her trade, her craft would be identified very often. And so we have some cases where we know that the wife was a skilled seamstress, let's say, and her husband was a tailor, and so she would have been helping in the household and helping in the family business, but only if after he died, perhaps, and she's living on her own, then you see her trade identified as a tailoress or a tailor or a seamstress. So there seems to have been some tendency on the part of the census taker not to identify women's trades if they were married and living with their husbands. I don't know why. You can imagine.
Sure. Well, and then in the last, in chapters 4 and 5, you sort of talk about the roles of women and the sort of wide variety of household structures that go on.
Let me mention one thing about the antebellum period before we move on chronologically. One of the most amazing things I found was that, well, a couple of things. Even after those laws were passed limiting African Americans' political opportunities, shall we say, that there were occasionally, apparently, African-Americans who actually voted in the elections, and white observers would complain in the newspaper that this had been going on. So that was pretty interesting. There was actually an African-American artisan who was a member of the otherwise white St. John's Masonic Lodge. So there were these exceptions to the rules that were fascinating. But one of the main thing I wanted to mention was that as times got worse in the 1850s, as sectional tensions grew worse, and a new generation of white leaders came along who were defenders of slavery and more partisan and political, a great number of New Bern and North Carolina's most talented three people of color simply left.
Right.
The leading artisans and their families from Newbern moved particularly to New Haven, Connecticut, and to Cleveland and Oberlin, Ohio. Some of their children had already gone to Oberlin to college. Mm-hmm. That was one of the few colleges at the time that would admit African-American as well as white students. But whole families moved to Oberlin and had long and distinguished careers of greater opportunity than they ever could have in the South. Charles Chestnut, the famous American writer, his family, his parents moved from Fayetteville to Cleveland or Oberlin, I forget, Cleveland, I believe, shortly before the Civil War. He was actually born up there, but he regarded Fayetteville as kind of home anyway, and he grew up there, but then he came back to North Carolina intermittently and described the situation in which one of the Fayetteville white leader after the war said, "Well, we lost all the best people of color. They all went north." And Chestnut said to him something like, "Well, you know, it's just getting too hot for us here. We'd lost the vote. We were afraid we'd be re-enslaved. We needed to get out." So there was a huge talent drain, a huge talent drain at that time.
Well, and coinciding with that was just sort of a general difficult economic recovery following the Civil War in New Bern. And so for those who did remain, there were sort of additional challenges. Mm-hmm. To the point that you made about the sort of fraternal organizations, there was the establishment of the first Black Masonic Lodge in the state, and that met with significant white resistance. And as you mentioned, some editorials. One of the things I thought was really great that there was sort of some person identified as an outrage editor, mm-hmm. who's yeah. sort of taking issue with these sorts of organizations. And I wonder if you would sort of talk a little bit about that.
Right. The Masonic Lodge in New Bern was founded immediately after the Civil War by leading Black artisans and the Black minister, James Walker Hood. And when that happened, the white newspaper editor in New Bern got all cranked up and objected to it, thought it was terrible, and thought that the white Masonic Lodge in the Grand Lodge in North Carolina should object. And they got kind of upset, but it turned out that it was not, as they surmised, coming out of the white New York Masonic Lodge, but out of Prince Lodge, which was an already established national Black Masonic system or lodge. But it showed that two or three things. For one thing, by that time, African-American leaders in New Bern were really well-organized and well-established and were determined to exercise their full rights as free people. As free people and as American citizens. One of the reasons that came along so early in New Bern was a chance event in history, was that in 1862, right at the less than a year after the Civil War started, Union troops captured New Bern and they occupied it throughout the rest of the war, and it became a free zone essentially. And so hundreds and thousands of former slaves escaped from wherever they were across the state, particularly in eastern North Carolina, and came to New Bern, you know, walked through the swamps and rivers and got there for freedom. And they, in freedom, with most of the white leadership having fled to get away from the Union occupation, they were able to create a sort of, as we say, a rehearsal for Reconstruction on their own that created their own political connections, their own political voice and identity. And they were seeking equal rights, like the vote, well before the Civil War was even over. They were strong, assertive. The figure Abraham Galloway, who was a Black, formerly enslaved brick mason from the Wilmington area, he turned up in New Bern, and he was an incredibly important radical leader and a Union spy. David Soselsky's book, The Fire of Freedom, is a biography of his amazing career. But he was just one of several figures, primarily artisan leaders, who created a political activity and political identity and life in New Bern that was really unique in the state and rare in the South.
Really interesting.
These people were, they just had such a clear sense of themselves,
right.
These leading artisans, as Americans and as people of consequence, that they just kept working to create their own identity, their own political life. And sometimes they encountered tremendous obstacles put in place by white leaders, and they just kept at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, without a doubt, the tenacity in the face of a lot of adversity is really impressive. And to that point, I want to sort of point listeners to your appendix, which I think is really just an exemplary specimen because of the biographical summaries that it contains are really, really, really great.
These are actual people, folks.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's really important to underscore that.
One of the things that people aren't as, at least in the history I learned, and many people aren't aware of, is that after the Civil War, people often think things went directly from Reconstruction to Jim Crow and disfranchisement. But actually, in New Bern and many places, from 1865 and from the state's enabling of the vote for all males in 1868, up until the 1890s, that was a long time in which there was blacks could vote, and in New Bern they did in good numbers. They were a majority of the population, and they were strong voters. They would fuss at people today who don't vote. I'll tell you, they treasured that vote, and they got out and voted, and in great numbers. And there were legislators from New Bern who were black. There was county officials, city councilmen. All sorts of offices were held by blacks, as well as whites. And there were often some pretty rough fracases over politics, what's new. And but there was a strong black political presence, as well as considerable success on the part of African-Americans in New Bern in terms of doing businesses, their trades, their businesses, and also in terms of they created their own churches. They created their own various and sundry civic organizations. Mm-hmm. Some flourished and grew wealthy. Some sent their children to college, and they sent them to school. There was a black public school eventually. They worked really hard for that. So they were very much into what some people have described as uplift, of moving toward successful lives. And some authorities, some writers assert that it was that degree of success that really spurred the white supremacists to conduct the nasty political campaigns of the 1890s in North Carolina that eventually resulted in disfranchisement and in 19 constitutional amendment that took away the voting for almost all blacks. It didn't say that, but that was the effect of it. That was what the civil rights movement had to work against in the mid-20th century. But there was this period of a remarkable degree of what they'd been seeking, what they'd been wanting. They were actually living out.
Well, and thanks for sort of underscoring that, because that is an important period that it is often elided in sort of the discussions that we have about these topics.
Let me mention one thing.
Yeah.
A lot of histories of all sorts of things, including black history, deal only with one period, like antebellum or early national period or Reconstruction or Civil War or whatever. And what I thought was important to do was to look at one place and it's these people, but in what some people have called a longitudinal way, which covers a long time. And so you can see how one event or one person affects the next thing that happens and how that changes in the next chapter, but some of the same people are still active. And so it connects the story through time in a way that often histories don't do. They just treat one period and you don't see what shakes out from the period before.
Right. And you mentioned sort of in the introduction to your book similar studies, particularly of African American artisans, avoid doing that. And so, this idea of a longitudinal, locally based study that your book steps into the breach in that way.
One of the neat things I found, and this was with the wonderful help of John Green, who's a librarian at the public library in Newbern, who looks up, he searches for obituaries in the newspapers, but because he knew what I was researching, and then they post them on the web, which is fabulous. He would send me little tidbits that he ran across from the local newspapers that were really helpful. But in any case, one of the things that he posts is obituaries from the newspapers. And in some cases, there would be an obituary of, let's say, in 1880, of an elderly black artisan. And it would tell his life. It would tell who he'd belonged to in slavery and other things about him. And so you got that sense of this longevity of memory and presence of people from the very early 19th century until the late 19th century. And that must have had a tremendous effect on how people understand their place in their community.
Absolutely. Well, that brings us to an interesting point, because you just sort of alluded to maybe the effect of public history on your book and the way and how your book was the research was informed. And I wonder if you might sort of turn it around and sort of tell us what you think the public effects of public history effects of the book have been or are.
Right. Thank you. That's one of the things that's turned out to be just really exciting for me. On the one hand, I'm happy if the book meets with approval and attention from scholars in universities and gets used in classes, and that I hope they will. And it's gotten one or two really nice reviews in historical journals. But what's been just such a treat is that it's become a resource for Newbern. Tryon Palace, as I mentioned, has emphasized this idea of one history, many stories. And this has become what we hoped would be a resource for generating that. And in particular, there have been several events that have used the material I found, and also folks in my local Newburnians and I have had conversations and made plans to incorporate this history into public events and public history events. So what it's functioning as is that it's functioning to some extent as a Black History of Newbern. And that's not been written before. Someday I hope somebody will write it. Somebody, not me. but it does, because of the importance of the artisans, and because I try to set it in the context of Newbern, it does give information. And so, for example, as shown in a photograph, about a year ago, when we had the launch of the book with talks and a reading and everything at Tryon Palace History Center, a launch of Crafting Lives, we tied it to another event that had come out of the book, which was, in my research, I had realized the importance of the first North Carolina volunteers of the U.S. Colored Troops, which had been organized in Newbern in 1862. So with that information, I and my friend in Newbern, Bernard George, who is a history buff and a Black reenactor of Civil War events, we proposed a highway historical marker for that event, for the first colored volunteers. And so we tied the unveiling ceremony on the same day to the book event. And so it turned out for lots of people. And it was a wonderful event with speeches and singing and the unveiling of the marker. And several people, including Bernard George, wore their union, their Black Union uniforms, which are terribly impressive. And it was just an inspiring event. And most recent, and then later on, I helped with the information, used our information we'd had to create some ghost walk characters, which is a Newbern Halloween thing where people dress up and perform as historic Newburnians. And a couple of the people that figured in my book, a couple of women, were reenacted. And that was nice. And now we're talking about an upcoming event, which is the celebration of George Washington's visit to Newbern in, I think, 1791. I don't remember dates as well as I should. And that's coming up in several months. And we're talking about how best to make that a bigger story. And one of the events would be perhaps a scene that's in my book where George Washington recognizes and greets
Asa.
a free black cooper named Asa Spellman.
That's right. Yeah.
And so that was part of the book. So in a way, I'm just thrilled that the book, that the people in New Bern are enjoying the book, and using it to expand the sense of history to encompass a more representative history than otherwise could be.
Yeah, that's a really great thing to be able to see, an almost instantaneous legacy of the book, and that must be very gratifying.
I love it.
Yeah, no, as well you should. Is there anything else that you have sort of on the horizon in terms of projects that you're working on?
Well, I'm doing some small projects right now, but I'm also continuing to be involved in generating material, creating biographies for my other ongoing project, which is a website at the North Carolina State University Libraries, where I work part-time, which is called NC Architects and Builders. And it's a series of biographical accounts and building lists for artisans as well as architects who worked in North Carolina. It includes a good number of the New Bern figures that I studied, but also all sorts of building artisans and architects who worked across the state. And it's ncarchitects.lib.ncsu.edu, and that's an ongoing project.
Oh, fantastic. Well, that sounds like a great project, and I certainly hope that everyone will go to the address mentioned and check that out. Catherine, I'd really like to just thank you for spending this time with us. I really enjoyed the book, and I've really enjoyed our conversation. So thanks very much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, thanks. And folks, we have had the pleasure of speaking with Catherine Beicher, author of Crafting Lives, African American Artisans in New Bern, North Carolina, 1770 to 1900.